That's the point, Trace says. He is a riddle. He puts the Jeep in gear, and they turn down the next aisle. Do you remember the other week when I went up to Phoenix to get components for the Dreamliner's electrical system?
You didn't go to Phoenix, Connor says. You went to meet with your bosses at Proactive Citizenry. Don't you think I know that?
Trace seems a bit surprised, then a bit pleased.
I didn't tell you because I didn't know whether you trusted me.
I don't.
Fair enough. Anyway, it was different this time. They didn't just meet with me. They flew me out to their main headquarters in Chicago. They had me give a full report to a packed conference room. Of course, I left out some key things, like our escape plan. I told them the Dreamliner is a new dormitory jet, and that the cockpit was dismantled and sold.
Oh, so it's not just me that you lie to.
They're not lies. It's disinformation, Trace says. After the meeting, I did some snooping. There was a marble wall in the lobby commemorating former presidents of the organization. Some names you'd probably recognize. Giants of business both before and after the war. But there was one name missing. It had been gouged right out of the marble, with no attempt to patch it up. And then, again, out in the garden, there was a sculpture of the founders. 5 of them, but clearly the pedestal was built for 6. There were still rust stains from where the 6th statue had once been.
Jansen, what's his face?
Reinschild.
Connor tries to work it out, but can't.
It doesn't make sense. If they wanted to disappear him, why not patch the marble? Why not get a smaller pedestal?
Because, says Trace. They didn't just want to disappear him. They wanted to make sure their members never forgot that they disappeared him.
Connor gets a chill in spite of the desert heat.
So what does all this have to do with us?
Before they flew me back, a couple of the friendlier suits took me to their private club, a place that served the kind of alcohol you can't even get on the black market. Real Russian vodka, tequila from before the agave extinction, stuff that must cost thousands of dollars a shot, and they were guzzling it like water. When they were fairly wasted, I asked about the missing statue. One of them blurted out the name Jansen Reinschild, then became worried that he had said it. After that, they changed the subject, and I thought it was over.
Then Trace stops the Jeep so we can look Connor dead in the eye as he speaks.
But then, as I was leaving, one of them said something to me that I still haven't been able to get out of my mind. He clapped me on the shoulder, called me his friend, and told me that unwinding is more than just a medical process. It's at the very core of our way of life. Proactive citizenry is dedicated to protecting that way of life, he said. And if you know what's good for you, you'll forget you ever heard his name.
37. Risa. Public service announcement.
I was a ward of the state about to be unwound, so I went AWOL. That means I shouldn't be here right now. You might think I'm lucky. But because I stayed whole, 14-year-old Morena Sandoval, an honor student with a bright future, died because she was denied the liver I would have provided. Jaron Stein, a father of 3, died of a fatal heart attack because my heart wasn't available when he desperately needed it. And firefighter Davis Macy lost his life to pulmonary asphyxiation because my lungs weren't there to replace his burned ones. I'm alive today because I ran from unwinding, and my selfishness cost these and many others their lives. My name is Risa Ward, AWOL Unwind, and now I must live knowing how many innocent people I've killed.
Sponsored by Citizens for AWOL Justice. 38. Hayden. Hayden stares at the computer screen, trying to believe Reese's public service announcement is some kind of sick joke, but he knows it's not. He wants to be furious at Tad, the busy little net raker who brought this to his attention, but he knows it's not the kid's fault.
What do we do now?
Tad asks. Hayden looks around the comm bomb. The 8 kids on communications duty all look at him as if he can make the video go away.
She's a goddamn traitor!
Esme shouts.
Shut up!
Hayden yells.
Just shut up! Let me think!
He tries to come up with alternate explanations. Maybe it's not real, just a digital image. Maybe it's a trick designed to demoralize them. But the truth screams louder than any conjecture. Risa is publicly speaking in favor of unwinding. She's gone to the other side.
Connor can't know about this, Hayden says.
Tad shakes his head doubtfully.
But it's been on TV and trending over the net since this morning. It's not just one, either. She made a whole bunch of public service announcements. And there's an interview, too.
Hayden paces the cramped space of the plane, trying to pull together a coherent thought.
Okay,
he says, forcing himself to calm down.
Okay. All the computers with web access are here in the comm bomb in the library, right? And the RecJet TVs all get their feed directly from here.
Yeah.
So, can we route everything through facial recognition software before it goes out and scramble it every time she turns up? Do we have a program that can do that?
No one answers for a few seconds. Then Jivan speaks up.
We have tons of old military security programs. There's got to be facial recognition stuff in there. I bet I can patch something together.
Do it, Jeeves.
Then he turns to Tad.
Cut the feeds to the RecJet and library until it's done. No incoming broadcasts or web connections at all. We'll tell everyone the satellite is out, or an armadillo mated with a dish or whatever. Got it?
Agreement all around.
And if any one of you breathes a word of this to anyone, I will personally make sure you spend the next few years of your life shoveling crap out of the latrines. The Risa bomb stays in the comm bomb. Comprende?
Again, total agreement. But Tad isn't quite ready to let it go.
Hayden, there was something about it I don't know if you noticed. Did you see how she...
No, I didn't,
says Hayden, shutting him down.
I didn't see a thing, and neither did you.
39. Connor. The man with proactive citizenry said that unwinding was at the core of the country's way of life. It sticks in Connor's gut just as it did in Trace's. Connor knows that things haven't always been the way they are now, but when the world's been one way for your entire life, it's hard to imagine it being any different. Years ago, before he was even of unwinding age, Connor got bronchitis, and it just kept coming back. There was actually talk about getting him new lungs, but the problem cleared up. He remembers feeling so sick for so long. After a while, he had forgotten what being well even felt like. Could it be that way for an entire society? Does a sick society get so used to its illness that it can't remember being well? What if the memory is too dangerous for the people who like things the way they are? Connor makes the time to go to the library jet to do some research, but the computers are offline, so he goes straight to Hayden.
You're telling me everything's down?
He asks Hayden. Hayden hesitates before answering.
Why? What do you need?
He almost seems suspicious, which is not like him.
I need to look something up, Connor tells him.
Can it wait?
It can, but I can't.
Hayden sighs.
Okay, I can get you online in the comm bomb, on the condition that you let me do the surfing.
What? Are you afraid I'll break the web?
Just humor me, okay? I've had a lot of computer issues, and I'm very protective of the equipment.
Fine. Let's just do this before I get dragged off to deal with someone's idea of an emergency.
The kids in the comm bomb are noticeably stressed as soon as they see Connor. He had no idea he inspires that level of fear.
Take it easy, he says. No one's in trouble.
And then he adds, yet.
Take 10.
Hayden tells them, and the kids file out and down the stairs, happy to be freed, at least temporarily, from their stations. Hayden sits down with Connor, who pulls out the slip of paper Trace gave him.
Do a search on this name.
Hayden types in Jansen Reinschild, but the results are not promising.
There's a Jordan Reinschild, an accountant in Portland, Jared Reinschild... Looks like he's a fourth grader, won some art contest in Oklahoma.
No Jansen?
A few J. Reinschilds,
offers Hayden. He checks them out. One's a mother with a low-hit blog about her kids. Another's a plumber. Not a single one seems to be the kind of person who would have a bronze statue erected to them, then destroyed.
So, who is he?
When I find out, I'll let you know.
Hayden swivels his chair to face Connor.
Is that all you were looking for?
Then Connor remembers something. Didn't the Admiral talk about events leading to our twisted way of life, too?
What were those things he said Connor should educate himself about?
I want you to look up The Terror Generation.
Hayden types it in.
What's that, a movie?
But when the results begin popping up, it's clear that it's not. There are tons of references. The Admiral was right. All the information is right there for anyone to find, but buried among the billions of web pages on the net. They zero in on a news article.
Look at the date,
says Hayden.
Isn't that right around the time of the Heartland War?
I don't know, Connor says. Do you know the actual dates of the war?
Hayden has no answer. Strange, because Connor can remember key dates of other wars, but the Heartland War is fuzzy. He's never been taught about it, has never seen TV shows about it. Sure, he knows it happened, and why, but beyond that, there's nothing. The first article talks about a spontaneous youth gathering in Washington, D.C. Hayden plays a news clip.
Whoa! Are those all people?
Kids,
Connor realizes.
They're all kids.
The clip shows what must be hundreds of thousands of teens packing the Washington Mall between the Capitol Building and the Lincoln Memorial, so dense you can't even see the grass.
Is this part of the war?
Hayden asks.
No, I think it's something else.
The reporter calls it the Teen Terror March, already putting a negative spin on the rally.
This is by far the largest flash riot anyone has ever seen. Police have been authorized to use the new controversial tranquilizer bullets to subdue the crowd.
The idea that tranq bullets could be controversial sets Connor reeling. They're just an accepted part of life, aren't they? Hayden scrolls down.
The article says they're protesting school closings.
That also throws Connor for a loop. What kid in their right mind would protest their school closing?
There, he says, pointing to a link that says, Fear for the Future.
Hayden clicks on it, and it brings up an editorial clip by some political pundit. He talks about the struggling economy and the collapse of the public education system.
A nation of angry teenagers with no jobs, no schools, and too much time on their hands. You bet I'm scared, and you should be too.
More reports. Those same angry kids calling for change. And when they don't get it, they hit the streets, forming random mobs, burning cars, breaking windows, letting loose a kind of communal fury. In the midst of the Heartland War, President Moss, just a few weeks before his assassination, calls an additional state of emergency, this time ordering a curfew on everyone under the age of 18.
Anyone caught breaking curfew will be subject to transport to juvenile detention camps.
There are reports of kids who have either left or been thrown out of their homes. Ferals, the news calls them, like stray dogs. Then comes a shaky video of three kids swinging their hands together. A sudden white flash, and the image becomes static.
Apparently, says the news anchor, these feral suicide bombers have altered their blood chemistry, so that bringing their hands together triggers detonation.
Holy crap, says Hayden. The first clappers!
All this was going on during the Heartland War, Connor points out. The nation was tearing itself apart over pro-life and pro-choice, but completely ignored the problems of the kids who are already here. I mean, no schools, no work, no clue if they'd even have a future. They just went nuts.
Tear it all down and start over.
Do you blame them?
Suddenly it was obvious to Connor why they don't teach it. Once education was restructured and corporatized, they didn't want kids knowing how close they came to toppling the government. They didn't want kids to know how much power they really had. The various links lead Connor and Hayden to an image that's much more widespread and familiar, hands being shaken at the signing of the Unwind Accord. In the background is the Admiral as a much younger man. The report talks about peace being declared between the Life Army and the Choice Brigade, giving everyone hope for domestic normalization. Nowhere are the teen uprisings mentioned. Yet within weeks of the accord, the juvenile authority was established. Feral detention centers became harvest camps, and unwinding became a way of life. That's when the truth hits Connor so brutally he feels lightheaded.
My God! The Unwind Accord wasn't just about ending the war. It was also a way to take down the Terror Generation.
Hayden leans away from the computer like it might start clapping and blow them all up.
The Admiral must have known that.
Connor shakes his head.
When his committee proposed the Unwind Accord, he never believed people would actually go for it. But they did, because they were more terrified of their teenagers than their consciences.
Connor knows that Jansen Rhineschild, whoever he was, must have played into this somewhere. But proactive citizenry was extremely thorough in wiping him off the face of the earth. 40. Starkey. Mason Starkey knows nothing of Jansen Rhineschild, the Terror Generation, or the Heartland War. If he did, he wouldn't care. The only teen uprising he has any interest in will involve the Stork Club. His motives are a complex weave of self-interest and altruism. He truly wants to raise his storks to glory, as long as they all know he's the one who's done it. Credit where credit is due, and honor to the trickster whose illusions finally become real. Starkey's hoping for a silent coup, but is prepared for anything. It will either be gracious, and Connor will see the wisdom of stepping aside for a more able leader, or he'll be steamrolled. Starkey will bear no guilt if it comes to that. After all, Connor, in spite of all his pretenses of fairness, still refuses to rescue storks from their unwindings.
"We saved the kids we're most likely to get away with saving," Connor told him. "It's not our fault that storks are in bigger families and more complicated situations."
It was the same excuse that Hayden had given him, but as far as Starkey is concerned, that's no excuse at all.
"So you're happy just letting them be unwound?"
"No, but there's only so much we can do."
"So little, you mean?"
Connor lost his temper then, which he does more and more often now.
"If it was up to you, we'd be blowing up harvest camps, wouldn't we? That's not how this battle is going to be won. It'll just make them come down harder on every unwind and every AWOL."
Starkey wanted to take his argument all the way to the wall and nail Connor to it for letting storks go unsaved. But instead, Starkey backed down.
"I'm sorry," he told Connor. "You know I get passionate when it comes to storks."
"Your passion's a good thing," Connor told him, "when you keep it in perspective."
He could have slammed Connor for that, but instead he just smiled, agreed, and left. Secure in the knowledge that someday soon, Connor would be faced with an entirely new perspective. While Connor has a history lesson with Hayden in the comm bomb, Starkey relaxes at the rec jet, teaching kids simple card tricks and dazzling them with close-up magic he could do in his sleep. It's Stork Hour, 7 to 8 p.m., prime time. There's a nice breeze blowing under the rec jet. It's a perfect time of day. He has one of the storks bring him a drink so he doesn't have to get out of his comfortable chair. It's been a hard day dishing slop, and although he doesn't actually do the dishing, supervision can be a bitch. Drake, the farm boy who runs the green aisle, passes and gives them a dirty look. Starkey glares back and makes a mental note. When he takes over, the new Holy of Holies will be made up of all storks. Drake will be demoted to picking beans or cleaning chicken crap. Many things will change when Starkey takes over, and God help anyone who's not in his good graces.
"You're going to get off your ass and play me a game of pool?"
Bam asks, pointing her cue at him like a harpoon.
"Or do my superior skills challenge your masculinity?"
"Watch it, Bam," Starkey warns.
He will not play her because he knows she'll win. First rule of competition, never accept a losing proposition. He loses when he plays Connor, of course, but that's different. It's intentional, and he makes sure the other storks know it. Farther down the main aisle, Connor comes down the stairs of the comm bomb with Hayden.
"What do you think that's all about?"
Bam asks. Starkey keeps his opinions to himself.
"I think they're hot for each other,"
says one of the other storks. Starkey turns to him.
"You're the only one I know who keeps checking out Connor's butt, Polly."
"That ain't true!"
But by the way Polly goes red, it's clear that it is. Finally, Starkey stands up to get a better look at the situation. Connor and Hayden say their goodbyes. Hayden heads toward the latrine, and Connor goes back to his own little jet.
He's been having private meetings with Trace, too.
Bam points out.
But he hasn't been sharing any secrets with you, has he?
Starkey hides his fury at being left out of whatever Connor is plotting.
He must be happy with food service.
A regular fatted cow,
Bam says with a grin.
Just about ready for slaughter.
I will not have you bad-mouthing our commander-in-chief.
Bam turns and spits on the ground.
You're such a freaking hypocrite.
Then she goes back to playing pool against kids who never beat her. Starkey, however, has no need to badmouth Connor. Griping is for those without a plan of action, and tonight Starkey has something new up his sleeve, a gift for Connor. It comes in the person of Jivan, whose skill with computers got him assigned to the comm bomb, and who happens to be a loyal Stork Club member. Of course, no one but Starkey knows that fact. Jeeves is one of two well-positioned sleeper agents, whose allegiance is to him rather than Connor. And what a gift Jeeves has provided. Starkey's been saving it for just the right moment. He concludes that now, when Connor seems to be getting his balance back, is the perfect time to unwrap it. And while the gift is in his arms, pull the rug out from under him. 41. Connor. Connor sits alone in his jet, staring into space, trying to process everything he's just learned.
"We can't stop unwinding," the Admiral once told him. "The best we can hope to do is save as many of these kids as we can."
But somehow, after seeing those old news reports, Connor is starting to feel that maybe the Admiral was wrong. Maybe there is a way to end unwinding, if only he can figure out how to truly learn from the past. Connor is still pondering the dark specter of history late into the evening when Starkey shows up at his jet. Connor opens the hatch for him. "What's up? Is there a problem?"
"You'll have to tell me if it's a problem,"
Starkey says enigmatically.
"Can I come in?"
Connor lets him in. "It's been a killer day. This had better be good."
"There's a TV here, right?"
Connor points to it.
"Yeah, but there's no line in and the color sucks."
"Don't need a line, and color's not gonna matter when you see what I've got."
Starkey pulls out a micro drive and plugs it into the TV's data port.
"You should sit down."
Connor laughs. "Thanks, but I'll stand."
"You sure?"
Connor gives him a funny look, continues standing, and waits for an image to come on the screen. He recognizes the show immediately. It's a weekly news magazine he has seen many times before. A familiar TV journalist discusses the featured story. The logo screened in behind her says, "Angel of Division."
"A little over a year ago,"
she begins,
"clappers took out an unwinding facility in Happy Jack, Arizona. The social and political fallout from that event still resonates today, but one girl, an infamous player in that event, is speaking out. Her message, however, is not what you think. You may have seen her in various public service announcements blitzing the airwaves. In a short time, she's gone from being one of the juvenile authorities most wanted to becoming the poster child for the cause of unwinding. Yes, you heard me right. For unwinding. Her name is Risa Ward, and you're not going to forget her anytime soon."
Connor takes a deep, shuddering breath and realizes that Starkey was right. He needs to sit down. His legs practically fall out from under him as he sinks into the chair. The studio shot cuts to Risa being interviewed in some plush location by the same journalist. There's something different about her, but Connor can't yet tell what it is.
"Risa,"
begins the journalist,
"you were a ward of the state slated for unwinding, became a co-conspirator with the notorious Akron AWOL, and were even present at Happy Jack Harvest Camp to witness his death. After all that, how is it that you now speak in favor of unwinding?"
Risa hesitates before answering, then says,
"It's complicated."
Starkey crosses his arms.
"Yeah, I'll bet it is."
"Quiet," snaps Connor.
"Could you walk us through it?"
the journalist asks, with a disarming grin that Connor wants to punch right off her face with Roland's fist.
"Let's just say I have a different perspective now than I had before. You've come to see unwinding as a good thing." "No, it's a terrible thing,"
she answers, which gives Connor hope.
until she says,
"But it's the least of all evils. Unwinding is there for a reason, and the world would be very different without it. Pardon me for pointing this out, but that's easy for you to say, now that you're 17 and beyond unwinding age." "No comment,"
says Risa, and it's like a dagger slowly twisting in Connor's gut.
"Let's talk about the charges against you,"
the journalist says, looking at her notes.
"Theft of government property, namely yourself. Conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism. Conspiracy to commit murder. And yet all these charges against you have been dropped. Does that have anything to do with your change of heart?" "I won't deny that I was offered a deal,"
Risa says,
"but the dropping of those charges is not the reason why I'm here today."
Then she does something very simple, something that no one else would notice in the slightest, except for those who know her. Risa crosses her legs. For Connor, it's as if the air has been sucked out of the jet. He half expects oxygen masks to drop from the ceiling.
"If you think that's bad, listen to this next part,"
says Starkey, actually seeming to enjoy it.
"Risa, would you call your change of heart a matter of convenience or a matter of conscience?"
Risa takes time to craft her answer, but that doesn't make it any less devastating.
"Neither,"
she says.
"After all I've been faced with, I find I have no choice. For me, supporting unwinding is a matter of necessity."
"Turn it off," Connor says.
"There's still more. You really should hear the end."
"I said turn it off." Starkey reaches over and turns off the TV, and Connor feels his mind slamming shut like a fire door to keep out all the things too hot to handle. But he knows it's too late. The fire has already leaped inside. In this moment, he wishes he had been unwound a year ago. He wishes Lev hadn't come in to save him, because then he would never have to feel what he's feeling now.
"Why did you show me this?"
Starkey shrugs.
"I thought you had a right to know. Hayden knows, but he's been keeping it from you. I think that's wrong and completely unfair to you. Knowing who's your friend and who's your enemy can only make you stronger, right?"
Yeah, sure,"
Connor says absently. Starkey grips his shoulder.
"It's okay. You'll get over it. We're all here to support you."
Then he leaves, his mission of enlightenment accomplished. Connor sits for a long time without moving. Although he knows he needs to be strong enough to carry this burden, he feels so shredded inside he doesn't know how he can make it through the night, much less take care of hundreds of unwinds in the days ahead. All those lofty ideas of exposing history to end unwinding implode into a single, desperate thought.
"Risa. Risa. Risa."
He is hobbled. How could Starkey not know how devastated he would be? Either he's stupider than Connor thought, or he's much, much smarter. 42. Starkey. Jeeves brings Starkey a copy of the list of local unwind orders. There are only 3 kids on this list deemed savable, and none of them are storks. But today is the day that things change. There is a storked kid on the list, ignored and forgotten. Jesus La Vega, 287 North Brighton Lane. Well, Connor doesn't have a monopoly on rescuing unwinds. It's high time Starkey took things into his own hands.
"Hey, we're saving Jesus instead of him saving us,"
someone says when Starkey tells the stork club his plan. Another kid raps him on the head.
"It's pronounced Jesus, moron."
But regardless of how he pronounces his name, Jesus is about to get a holy visitation. At 11 o'clock p.m., one day before the juvies are due to come for Jesus, Starkey and 9 stork clubbers storm the house at 287 North Brighton Lane. They have weapons, because Starkey picked the arsenal lock. They have cars, because the kid in charge of vehicle maintenance is a loyal member of the stork club. They don't knock. They don't ring. They break down the doors, front and back, crashing the place like a SWAT team taking down a crack house. A woman screams and herds 2 younger kids to a back room. Starkey doesn't see anyone the right age to be the target of their rescue. He goes into the living room in time to see a man pull down a curtain rod and turn to him. It's the closest thing to a weapon the man can find on such short notice.
Starkey easily disarms him and pushes him up against the wall with the muzzle of a submachine gun to his chest.
Jesus La Vega, tell me where he is, now!
The father's eyes dart back and forth in panic, then fix on something behind Starkey. Starkey turns in time to see a baseball bat swinging at him. He ducks, and the bat breezes past an inch from his head. The kid holding the bat is the size of a linebacker.
No, stop! You're Jesus La Vega, right? We're here to save you!
But that doesn't stop him from swinging the bat again. It connects with Starkey's side, an explosion of pain. Starkey goes down, his weapon flies behind a sofa, and now the kid is over him, hefting the bat once more. Starkey can't catch his breath. His side hurts so much he can only breathe shallow gulps of air.
Juvie's here tomorrow,
Starkey gasps.
Your parents unwinding you. Nice try,
he says, and pulls back the bat, ready to swing again.
Run, Dad, get out!
The man tries to scramble away, but is cornered by other storks.
Doesn't this kid get it? Doesn't he realize they already signed the order to have him unwound?
Jesus La Vega tenses his muscles to swing, just as one of Starkey's storks comes up behind him with a large football trophy and swings the marble base at his head. The heavy stone connects with the back of Jesus's head, and he crumples to the ground instantly. The trophy falls to the floor, broken.
What did you do?
Screams Starkey.
He was gonna kill you!
Screams the stork. Starkey kneels down beside Jesus. Blood pours out of his head, soaking the carpet. His eyes are half open. Starkey feels for a pulse, but can't find one. And when he turns the kid's head, he can see how badly his skull was crushed by the heavy trophy base. One thing is certain. Jesus La Vega is not going to be unwound, because he's dead. Starkey looks to the kid who did it, who panics under Starkey's gaze.
I didn't mean it, Starkey. Honest, I swear. He's gonna kill you. It's not your fault.
Starkey tells him, then turns to the kid's father, who's cornered like a spider.
You did this!
Starkey screams.
You kept him here all his life, just so you could unwind him. Do you even care that he's dead?
The man is horrified by the news.
Dead? No. Don't pretend you care.
Starkey can't hold it in anymore. He can't hold back. This man, this monster who would unwind his stork-brought son, has to pay for what he's done. Ignoring the pain in his side, Starkey swings his foot, connecting with the man's torso.
He should feel this pain, not me. He should feel all of it.
Starkey kicks again and again. The man screams. The man moans. But Starkey keeps swinging his foot, unable to stop. It's as if he's channeling the fury of every doorstep baby, every unwanted child, all kids everywhere who were treated like something less than human just because they were born to mothers who didn't want them. Finally, one of the other storks grabs Starkey, pulling him away.
That's enough, man,
he says.
He gets the idea.
The man, bloody and beaten, still has enough strength to crawl out the door. The rest of his family has escaped too, running to neighbors. They've probably called the police, and Starkey realizes that he can't stop now. He's gone too far. He has to take this all the way. This isn't what he wanted, but somehow he can use it. Yes, the kid they came to rescue is dead, but this night can't end with that. It has to stand for something. It has to be worth something. Not just for Starkey, but for all storks.
Let this be a warning!
He yells out the front door as the man stumbles away. He spots neighbors on their porches. Strangers are there to hear his words. Good. It's time for people to listen.
Let this be a warning!
He says again.
To anyone who would unwind a stork! You will all get what's coming to you!
Then, in a flash of inspiration, he runs through the house and into the garage.
Starkey!
One of the others yells after him.
What the hell are you doing? You'll see.
In the garage, he finds a gas can. It's only half full, but half is enough. He runs through the house pouring gasoline everywhere. And on the mantle above the fireplace, he finds a book of matches. Moments later, he's racing across the lawn away from the house, toward his friends in the waiting jeeps.
while an ominous glow rises within the house behind him. By the time he climbs into a jeep, flames are rising in the windows, and the moment the jeep screech away into the night, those windows begin to explode, and smoke pours forth from the rising inferno. The entire house has become a blazing beacon to let the world know that Mason Starkey was here, and people are going to pay. 43. Avalanche.
This document I sign of my own free will.
That was the last line of the consent form that Risa Ward signed, just as Roberta had predicted she would. Signing that form has given her a new spine and the use of her legs. But that's not all it did. It set into motion a cascading series of events that Risa could not have predicted, and yet was expertly orchestrated by Roberta, her associates, and their money.
I sign of my own free will.
Risa has never gone skiing. Such frivolous activities were not offered to state wards. Yet lately she's been dreaming that she's skiing down a triple black diamond slope, chased by the leading edge of an avalanche. There's no stopping until she either reaches the bottom or sails off a cliff to her doom.
My own free will.
Before the news interviews, before the public service announcements, before she knows any of what she'll be asked to do, Risa's damaged spine is replaced, and she awakes from a 5-day medically induced coma into her brave new life. 44. Risa.
Tell me if you can feel this,
a nurse says, scraping Risa's toe with a strip of plastic. Risa gasps in spite of herself. Yes, she feels it, and it's not just a phantom sensation. She can feel the sheets brushing against her legs. She can feel her toes again. She tries to move them, but just moving her toes makes every part of her body ache.
Don't try to move, dear,
the nurse tells her.
Let the healing agents do their job. We're using second-generation healing agents. You'll be up and walking in 2 weeks.
It speeds her heart to hear those words. She wishes the connection between her heart and her mind could be more direct, that the part of her that wants this could be firmly ruled by the part of her that doesn't. Because although her mind wants to despise what they've done for her, the part of her that knows no reason is filled with joy at the prospect of holding her own balance and moving under the power of her own legs.
You'll require a lot of physical therapy, of course. Not as much as you might think, though.
The nurse checks the devices that are attached to her legs. They are electrical stimulators, which cause her muscles to contract, awakening them from their atrophied state, building them back to prime body tone. Each day she feels like she's run miles, although she hasn't left the bed. She's no longer in a cell. It's not really a hospital either. She can tell it's some sort of private home. She can hear the roar of ocean surf outside her window. She wonders if the staff knows who she is and what happened to her. She chooses not to bring it up, because it's too painful. Better just to take it day by day and wait until Roberta comes for her again, to tell her what more she has to do to fulfill the terms of her so-called contract. It's not Roberta who visits her, though. It's Cam. He's the last person she wants to see, if she indeed can call him a person. His hair has filled in a bit since the time she first saw him, and the scars on his face from the various grafts are slimmer. You can barely see the seam where the different skin tones touch.
I wanted to see how you were feeling,
he says.
Sick to my stomach,
she tells him.
But that only started when you walked in.
He goes to the window and opens the blinds a bit more, letting in bars of afternoon light. A particularly loud wave crashes on the shore outside the window.
The ocean is a mighty harmonist,
he says, quoting someone she's probably never even heard of.
When you can walk, Cam tells her, you should look at your view. It sure is pretty this time of day.
She doesn't answer him. She just waits for him to leave, but he doesn't.
I need to know why you hate me,
he asks.
I've done nothing to you. You don't even know me, but you hate me. Why?
I don't hate you,
Risa admits.
There's no you to hate.
He comes up beside her bed. I'm here, aren't I? He puts his hand on hers, and she pulls away.
I don't care who or what you are. Nobody touches me.
He thinks for a moment, then says in all seriousness,
Would you like to touch me, then? You can feel all the seams. You can see what makes me, me.
She doesn't even dignify that with a response.
Do you think the kids who are unwound to be a part of you wanted it?
If they were tithes, they did,
Cam said,
and some of them were. As for the other ones, they had no choice, any more than I had a choice in being made.
And for a moment, within the fury she feels toward the people who created him, Risa realizes that Cam, as much as all the kids who were unwound to make him, is a victim too.
Why are you here?
She asks him.
I've lots of answers to that one, Cam says proudly. The sole purpose of human existence is to kindle a light in the darkness of mere being, Carl Jung.
Risa sighs, exasperated.
No, why are you here, in this place, talking to me? I'm sure proactive citizenry has more important things for their beta tests to do than talk to me.
Where the heart is, he says. I'm here because this is my home. But I'm also here because I want to be.
He smiles at her, and she hates the fact that his smile is sincere. She has to keep reminding herself that it's not his smile at all. He's just wearing the flesh of others. And if it was all peeled away, there'd be nothing in the center. He is little more than a cruel trick.
So did your brain cells come pre-programmed? A head full of ganglia implants from the best and the brightest?
Not all of them.
Cam says quietly.
Why do you keep holding me responsible for the things I had no control over? I am what I am.
Spoken like a true god.
Actually, he says, returning a little bit of her attitude, God said, I am that I am, if you're going by the King James Version.
Don't tell me. You came programmed with the entire Bible.
In three languages, Cam says. Again, not my fault. It's just there.
Risa has to laugh at the audacity of his creators. Did it occur to them that filling him with biblical knowledge while playing God was the ultimate hubris?
And anyway, it ain't like I can regurgitate it verbatim. I just got a working knowledge of a whole lot of stuff.
She looks at him, wondering whether the sudden change in speech pattern from advanced placement to country casual is a joke, but she can tell it's not. She supposes, as connections spark through the various and sundry bits of his brain, he kicks out all kinds of talk.
May I ask you what made you change your mind?
He asks.
Why did you agree to the operation?
Risa looks away.
I'm tired,
she tells him, even though she's not, and shifts to face away from him. Even this action of rolling sideways in her bed was something she could not easily accomplish before the operation. When it becomes clear that she's not going to answer him, he asks,
May I come see you again?
She keeps her back to him.
No matter what I say, you'll come anyway, so why bother asking?
Well, he says as he leaves, It would be nice to have permission.
She lies there in that position for a long time, trying not to give a foothold to any of the thoughts swimming through her mind. Finally, she dozes off. This is the first night she dreams of the avalanche. Roberta is off somewhere taking care of business on the day Risa first walks, and only a week after waking up instead of two. It's a day that brings to a head all her conflicted emotions. She wants this to be a personal moment, not something shared, but as usual, Cam comes uninvited.
Milestone, this is a momentous occasion,
he tells her cheerily.
It should be witnessed by a friend.
She throws him an icy gaze, and he does a verbal backpedal.
And since no friends are present, I'll have to do.
A male nurse who looks more like a steroid-pumped buff grabs Reese's upper arm and helps her swing her legs off the bed. It's an unearthly sensation to actually feel them cantilevered out over the floor. She bends her knees shakily until she feels the tips of her toes touch the wooden floor.
They should have a rug on the floor,
Cam tells Nurse Beefcake.
to make it softer for her.
Rug slip,
Nurse Beefcake replies. With the nurse holding her on one side and Cam on the other, she rises to her feet. The first step is the hardest. It's like dragging her foot through mud. But the second step comes with remarkable ease.
Atta girl,
says the nurse, like he's talking to a baby taking her first step. And in a sense, she is. She has no balance whatsoever, and her knees feel like they'll give out at any moment, but they don't.
Keep going, Cam says. You're doing great.
By the fifth step, she can't hold back the visceral joy she's been suppressing. A smile fills her face. She becomes short of breath and giggles giddily at the simple joy of walking.
That's it, says Cam. You're doing... You're whole again, Risa. You have a right to enjoy it.
And although she doesn't believe that's true, she can't fight the moment.
The window, she says. I want to look out the window.
As they turn slightly to angle toward the window, Nurse Beefcake tentatively lets go, and now it's just Risa with her arm around Cam's shoulder and his arm around her waist, and she wants to be furious that she wound up stuck in this position with him, but that feeling is overridden by giddy sensory overload from her feet, her ankles, her shins, her thighs, parts of her body that just a few short days ago felt nothing at all. 45. Cam. For Cam, this is nothing short of heaven. She's holding him, relying on him. He convinces himself that this is the moment that all the barriers will fall. He's convinced she will turn to him and kiss him even before they reach the window. She grips his neck tightly for support. Her hold on him pinches the seam there, but it's a good feeling. He imagines her putting pressure on all his seams, making them ache. No pain could ever feel so good. They reach the window. No kiss, but she hasn't let go of him either. She can't, or she'll fall, but Cam wants to believe she'd hold him anyway. The sea is rough this morning. Spray launches high into the air with the pounding of 8-foot rollers. An island can be seen in the distance.
No one ever told me where we are.
Molokai, Cam tells her, in Hawaii. The island used to be a leper colony.
And Roberta owns this place?
Cam detects unveiled bitterness in the way Risa says her name.
It's owned by Proactive Citizenry. Actually, I think about half of the island is. This place was some rich guy's summer home once, but now it's their medical research center. And Roberta is the head of medical research.
Are you her only project?
It's a question Cam has never even considered before. As far as he knows, he is the center of Roberta's universe.
You don't like her, do you?
Who, me? No, I love her dearly. Evil scheming bitches are my favorite kind of people.
Cam feels a sudden protectiveness and an unexpected spike of anger.
Red light,
he blurts.
She's the closest thing I have to a mother.
You'd be better off storked.
Easy for you to say. A ward like you doesn't even know what a mother is.
Risa gasps, then brings her hand back and slaps him hard across the face. The momentum of the slap pushes her off balance, and she falls backward, but the nurse is there to catch her. He gives Cam an accusing glance, then returns his attention to Risa.
Enough for now,
the way too muscular male nurse says.
Back into bed.
He helps Risa back to bed while Cam stands impotently at the window, not sure who to be mad at, himself, her, or the nurse for taking her away from him.
Did the slap sting evenly, Cam?
She asks with a nasty bite in her voice.
Or do the kids in your face all feel it differently?
Jefflon,
he says, refusing to let her comment stick.
Muzzle!
He cannot let himself lash out again. He cannot. He takes a deep breath, picturing the tumultuous sea calming to a glassy lake.
I know. I invited that slap,
he tells her calmly.
But watch what you say about Roberta. I do not speak unkindly of the people you love. Have the same courtesy for me.
Cam gives Risa some space. He knows this change in her life must be as traumatic as it is wonderful for her. He still doesn't quite understand what made Risa change her mind about allowing the operation, but he knows Roberta can be persuasive. He likes to pretend that some of it had to do with him, that deep down, beneath her initial repulsion, was a curiosity, perhaps even an admiration for the mosaic that had been created from all his disparate parts. Not the one they put together for him, but how he took what he was given and made it all work. They eat one meal a day together.
"It is imperative," Roberta tells him, "if the two of you are ever going to bond, that you dine together. Meals are when the psyche is most vulnerable to attachment."
He wishes Roberta didn't make it all sound so clinical. Growing accustomed to each other's company shouldn't be about Risa's vulnerability to attachment. Risa does not yet know that she is here to be his companion.
"Do not rush this," Roberta has told Cam. "She must be groomed for the role, and we have other things planned for her first. We're turning her folk legend status to our advantage, creating a powerful media presence before we link the two of you together publicly. That will take time. In the meantime, be your wonderful, charming self. She is yours to win."
"And if I don't?"
"I have every confidence in you, Cam."
Risa is in his thoughts through each activity of the day. She becomes a thread weaving through all the seams of his mind, binding them together more tightly. And she's thinking of him, too. He knows because of the way she watches him secretly. He plays basketball one afternoon with an off-duty guard. He has his shirt off, revealing not only his seams, but his musculature in tip-top shape. A boxer's six-pack abs, a swimmer's powerful pecs, flawless muscle groups reined in by a finely tuned motor cortex to produce the perfect layup. Risa watches him play from a window in the main living room. He knows, but he doesn't let on. He just delivers spectacular game, allowing his body to speak for itself. Only when he's done playing does he glance up at her, to let her know that her stolen glimpses of him aren't stolen at all. They're given freely. She backs away from the window into shadows. But they both know she was watching. Not because she had to, but because she wanted to. And Cam knows that makes all the difference in the world. 46. Risa. Risa walks up the spiral staircase. Risa walks down the spiral staircase. Risa works with Kenny, the physical therapist, who keeps telling her how quickly she's gaining strength. She hears no news of the outside world. For all she knows, it no longer exists, and this island clinic, which is not a clinic at all, quickly feels like home, and she hates that. As much as Risa dreads the daily meal with Cam, she also finds herself looking forward to it. It's out on the veranda, weather permitting, and whichever meal it is, it's always the best meal of the day. Cam, who has been happy to show off his remarkable physique to her from a distance, is awkward at the meals, and just as uncomfortable as she is to be thrust together like it's some sort of arranged marriage. They don't speak of the day she slapped him. They don't speak about much of anything. Risa puts up with him. Cam puts up with her putting up with him. Finally, he breaks the ice.
"I'm sorry about that day,"
he says as they eat steaks together on the veranda.
"I was just upset. There's nothing wrong with being a state ward. In fact, parts of me know what it's like. I have memories of state homes, more than one."
Risa looks down at her food.
"Please don't talk to me about that. I'm eating."
But he doesn't stop.
"They're not the nicest of places, are they? You have to fight for every bit of attention. Otherwise you live a life of bare adequacy, which is the worst life of all."
She looks up at him. He's put into words the feelings she's always had about the way she grew up.
"Do you know which homes you are in?"
she asks.
"Not really,"
he tells her.
"There are images, feelings, specific memories, but for the most part, my language center didn't come from state wards."
"I'm not surprised,"
Risa says.
"Language skills are not a strong point at state homes."
She grins.
"Do you know your history?"
Cam asks.
How you ended up there, who your birth parents are.
Risa feels a lump in her throat and tries to swallow it down.
No one knows that information.
I can get it for you,
Cam tells her. It leaves her with a feeling of dread and anticipation, and this time she's very pleased to say that the dread wins out.
It's not something that I've ever needed to know, and I don't need to know now.
Cam looks down, a little disappointed, maybe a little bit crushed, and Risa finds herself reaching across the table to clasp his hand.
Thank you for offering. It was very kind of you, but it's something I've come to terms with.
It's only when she lets go of his hand that she realizes that it's the first time she has voluntarily made physical contact with him. The moment is not lost on him, either.
I know you were in love with the boy they call the Akron AWOL,
Cam says. Risa tries not to react.
I'm sorry he died,
Cam says. Risa looks at him in horror until he says,
That must have been a horrible day at Happy Jack Harvest Camp, to be there when it happened.
Risa takes a deep, shuddering breath. So Cam doesn't know he's alive. Does that mean that proactive citizenry doesn't know either? It's something she can't speak of, can't ask about, because it would provoke too many questions.
Do you miss him?
Cam asks. Now Risa can tell him the truth.
Yes, I do. Very much.
It's a long time before Cam speaks again, and when he does, he says,
I would never ask to take his place in your heart, but I hope there's room for me in there, as a friend.
I make no promises,
says Risa, trying to sound less vulnerable than she truly feels.
Do you still think I'm ugly?
Cam asks her.
Do you still think I'm hideous?
Risa wants to answer him truthfully, but it takes a while to find the right words. He takes her hesitation for an attempt to spare his feelings. He looks down.
I understand.
No,
Risa says.
I don't think you're hideous. It's just that there's no way to measure you. It's like looking at a Picasso and trying to decide if the woman in the painting is ugly or beautiful. You don't know, but you can't stop looking.
Cam smiles.
You see me as art. I like that.
Yeah, well, I never cared for Picasso.
That makes Cam laugh, and Risa does too, in spite of herself. The cliffside plantation estate has a rose garden filled with well-pruned hedges and exotic aromatic flowers. Risa, having been raised in the concrete confines of an inner-city state home, was never much of a garden girl. But once she was allowed access, she began coming out daily, if only to pretend that she isn't a prisoner. The sensation of walking again is still new enough to make every step in the garden feel like a gift. Today, however, Roberta is there, preparing some sort of miniature production. There is a small camera crew, and smack in the middle of the garden sits her old wheelchair. The sight of it brings back a flood of too many emotions to sort through right now.
Would you mind telling me what this is all about?
Risa asks, not sure she really wants to know.
You've been on your feet for almost a week now, Roberta tells her. It's time to deliver on the first of the services you've agreed to perform.
Thank you for wording it just the right way to make me feel like I'm prostituting myself.
For a moment, Roberta is flustered, but she's quick to recover her poise.
I meant it no such way, but you do have a knack of taking things and twisting them.
Then she hands Risa a sheet of paper.
Here are your lines. You'll be recording a public service announcement.
Risa has to laugh at that.
You're putting me on TV?
And in print ads, and on the net. It's the first of many plans we have for you.
Really? And what else do you have planned?
Roberta smiles at her.
You'll know when it's your time to know.
Risa reads over the single paragraph, and the words go straight to the pit of her stomach.
If you're unable to memorize them, we have cue cards prepared, Roberta says.
Risa has to read the paragraph twice just to convince herself she's actually seeing what she's seeing.
No, I won't say this. You can't make me say this.
She crumples the page and throws it down.
Roberta calmly opens her folder and